change from today that you may have noticed, of course, are not only the more obvious ones in communications, in food, in dress, but you would have noticed also a certain atmosphere, attitudes and perceptions, which we are apt to think of limited because we no longer agree to what was always assumed, namely the truth of Christianity. Christianity is a guiding force. Christianity is the force to resort to in order to make life meaningful. And therefore, I must start quite logically talking about this kind of Christianity, which we have toward 1700 at the beginning of our period, because everything else follows from that. And it isn't only part of the 18th century that believed Christianity was the enemy, but in the 19th century, people like Hegel and even Marx, to a greater degree, still thought that if you were going to fight something, it would be Christianity, which really symbolizes the enemy. And you can see the change and the loss of Christianity's monopoly, that today nobody would think that anymore, really. But Christianity was a large mantle. It had many mansions. There were Protestants, there were Catholics. There was room for doubt. There was room for reason. But all of this had its limitations. All of this influenced man's perceptions in a certain way. Now, by that, I do not mean that most people were churched. That is to say, they went to church necessarily. That wasn't true. We just don't know. But we are talking about basic assumptions which people shared. Whether they went to church or not is quite immaterial from that point of view. Basic assumptions and traditions. The only religion, really, most Europeans had known, the only traditions of thought in which most Europeans had grown up. No one as yet thought, really, that you could do without religion. And no one at all thought that you could get along without God. Even when you have in the 17th century the so-called atheists, what they really were deists. They believed in God, but perhaps not in Christ. But there was nobody who did not believe in God. And certainly, almost everybody assumed the truth of Christ's mission and salvation and the liturgy which went with it. You can see it in another way, that the questions that were asked by philosophers, not only philosophers, were quite different than the questions we would ask today. We would think them today rather nonsensical. Eventually, I will come to the question of Pierre Bayle, the first real philosopher of doubt, to whom I'll come to eventually. Why are Christians bad? Now, we assume today Christians are bad. But Bayle still devoted a great deal of a book to answering these questions. Why are Christians bad? But a still more startling example, the great master of the Enlightenment, Voltaire. Voltaire's famous poem, which he wrote in despair, after in 1755, there was an event which seemed to cast all doubting of religion, well, let me put it this way, which cast all religion into a kind of cauldron of doubt, and you didn't know where you were. And that was the great catastrophe of the 18th century, the earthquake of Lisbon of 1755. In 1755, the city of Lisbon was destroyed by an earthquake. Now, this made a very serious problem. Because how could God allow that? How could this happen, this kind of earthquake? Whether the world was reasonable, whether the world was Christian, it had to have some kind of explanation, but it had no explanation. And so Voltaire wrote some lines which I think are very typical for the basic assumptions, which even men of the Enlightenment were apt to share. This is what he said in his Reflections on the Earthquake of Lisbon. Men, beasts, and elements know no repose. From dire contention, earth the seat of woes. We strive in vain its secret source to find. Is ill the gift of our Creator kind? There you always have the question, what about the Creator who is supposed to be kind? Are his gifts ill? Now, I realize full well that that question is still today unanswerable. It's the great question after Auschwitz, after all, especially in Jewish theology, unanswered, really undealt with. You know, how could God let Auschwitz happen, you see? And for Voltaire, it was the Lisbon earthquake which was a catastrophe. But the whole questioning was circumscribed within this kind of frame of mind, within these kind of assumptions. And that, I think, is very important to realize. In these assumptions, I'm not even talking about popular piety, what the people themselves believed. What the people themselves believed, their universe, that will not change very much during our entire period. By and large, popular piety, popular belief, was a reaching out for certainty, for security, the worship of saints, the cures, the holy waters, and the fact that it made no difference towards 1700 and not towards 1800, whether you were Catholic or you're Protestant. You still, if foot and mouth disease struck your cattle, you still went to holy water to sprinkle them with it, yes? You still wanted your saints' relics to touch and to worship. You still reached out for Christian symbols in a very immediate sort of way. Amulets, all this sort of thing flourished in Protestantism as well as in Catholicism. It was a quest for safeguards which you had. And on the popular level, similarly, you never lose the importance of liturgy. Now, the symbol of safeguards are, of course, saints you can touch, relics you can touch, amulets you can wear, all of these kind of things, which, as I told you last time, cut the shock of life. Lisbon earthquakes, that sort of thing, to manageable size. As I told you last time, you can either elevate things into the sacred, or you can cut them down to size. With knickknacks or liturgy, they fulfill much the same function from this point of view, to cut them down to manageable size. And therefore, what you have here is, of course, the great importance on the popular level, first of all, of what the 18th century will call superstitions, but what we must call the quest for religious safeguards, for religious symbols. The great things that were read, the main reading, were calendars. Calendars which were full of prophecies of the future, calendars which told you about the task or the miracles of the local saint. Calendars which transformed the world, into an immediate personalization. For I come back here again that on the popular level, still more, of course, than on the level of the intellectuals, there was the quest for personalization. And however abstract the world became in the 18th century, as you will soon realize, the world of personalization remained on the popular level. The popular level wants immediate symbols. And it cannot, of course, think in abstractions. So it must be immediate. So you have this quest for a personalized world. And these peasants' calendars, prophecies, they, in a way, draw everything into a personal God, a personalized life, God speaking not only through the burning bush, but through the mouth of animals, all this sort of thing you will find in the Bible as well, things you can touch and you can listen to, and all of that sort of thing which make God personal and not abstract. Now, that's one reason why the idea of reason and the Enlightenment will never catch on the popular level, because it's difficult to think of God as abstraction. But God in the burning bush is one thing. God as Voltaire's clockmaker is another. And on the popular level, you could not expect the God as Voltaire's clockmaker, the man who makes the clock and then the clock runs by itself. On the popular level, you could not expect that to penetrate. There was the constant search for these safeguards, which hasn't vanished, I dare say, to this day. Magic, of course, as the background for science eventually, but magic, alchemy, all these things to try and understand a world that was frightening, to personalize it, to bring Christianity down into symbols. And the greatest symbol of Christianity is the Christian Mass. So we get all these accounts how when the priest transformed Christ's blood, the wine, transformed the wine into Christ's flesh and blood, people cried out, higher, higher, so that they could see the sacred cup at the altar. To them, it was, in a sense, a safeguard, a hope, the only hope they really had in some senses, a safeguard, a hope, and the church was, in a way, their living room. But more than that, not only their living room, therefore it must be beautiful, of course, in the Baroque and so on, but much more than their living room, their hope, their safeguard, or to put it in modern terms, popular piety, popular culture, tends always towards fetishism, towards making a fetish, if you like, of things, symbols that you are concrete, that you can touch and so on, that are personalized. That is why the worship of saints, which the church always deplored but could never stop, the worship of saints and relics, even by Protestantism, the magic cures like holy water or the other great cure, taking a relic of a saint and grinding it up and eating it, which was what penicillin is to us and probably just as effective for all I know. So what you have therefore here is quite clearly always the idea to bring it down to size, to bring it down to size. So that I'm making this point because I don't intend now to talk about popular culture very much further, because the kind of thought that I want to talk about now, because we are dealing with the Enlightenment first, in the prehistory of the Enlightenment, is the kind of thought that was to influence intellectuals. Because the thought, the change in our society, the change in our perceptions, do not come from popular culture. They do not come from Rousseau's invention, the people. The people can storm the Bastille. That's all they can do. And at the end of the 19th century, when there is the machine gun, they can't even storm a Bastille anymore. They're mowed down by the machine gun. You understand that. Lenin understood that very well. So, in other words, the change does not come, of course, from below, because popular culture is the same. Even the reading matter is largely the same for centuries. It won't change very much. The change will come, if you like, from intellectuals, or a correspondence between intellectuals on the one hand and certain social, political, and economic constellations on the other. Here the change comes from intellectuals on the one hand and the industrialization of Europe and the other, and the problems in a way connected with the industrialization. If you want to put it in modern vocabulary, popular culture always remains stuck in underdevelopment, in a way, which would be true, I think, to say, very largely till the end of the 19th century, when you get a greater literacy. Remember, most of Europe was illiterate. Remember something else that's always forgotten. Compulsory education in Europe doesn't come till the 1880s. Now, I realize that at the beginning of the 19th century, there was a great deal of self-education among one part of the lower classes, whom I am here exempting, the artisan class. We shall talk about that later. The artisan class, tailors and carpenters and artisans, tried to educate themselves. And they were, of course, the first to try to organize labor at the beginning of the 19th century. But by and large, you get popular culture the same, with one change in our period, which comes through the great Second Reformation, through that great religious revival in the 18th century. It becomes more inward. In other words, in the end, it's not only fetishization, it is also becomes an outlet for frustrations. You come to Christ, you declare for Christ. Well, you should know that evangelism even today is a lower class matter. Even today, most of evangelism is what we would say a lower class matter, an outlet for frustration. Coming to Christ, declaring for Christ, is a sort of a different way, an inwardness, which comes only with pietism and evangelism in the 18th century. But the only thing that touched popular culture was not the Enlightenment. It was, in fact, the religious reformation. Because culture, popular culture always remained religious, always wedded to certainty. And as I tried to tell you last time, nothing is more difficult to change than religious liturgy, any liturgy. And as I tried to tell you, too, at the end very rapidly, one reason, and I think the main reason, why Martin Luther succeeded, where a lot of people before him had failed, is he didn't change the liturgy, really. If you'd gone to a Protestant and Catholic church, it would have been much the same liturgy. He didn't change much, really. Because whenever you change people's liturgy, that is to say, their kind of certainty, their symbolism, their rhythm, which their own rhythm of activity interacts with symbols. In this vital thing for people, where their rhythm or their actions interacts with the symbols, which would be in Christian service and Christian liturgy, people don't go in for change. That is the most difficult thing to change, as I say, Martin Luther already realized. And it won't change, in fact, very much, except that the Second Reformation, pietism and evangelism will effect it and make it more inward. That universe of popular culture and the universe of Christianity in general can also be characterized through an image which is taken from the classics and has a long history, an image which we call the golden chain of being. And that image had become widespread and popularized even down into the population. And that image of the golden chain of being, what is it? It is two things at once. It is a hierarchy of authority, and it puts men into a complete context. What is it, really? It means that everybody is in a kind of hierarchy, a hierarchy that stretches from God to Christ, to the archangels, to the not-so-archangels, down to men, or rather to the nobility, through the presence, and eventually, of course, to the blacks and the apes and all sorts of animals, to the devil. In other words, it's a complete chain in which everybody has its place. Everybody has his place. And in that chain, there must never be any gaps. There must never be any gaps. And you'll see what importance this will have for racism later, when the black becomes the neighbor of the ape in this kind of chain. Yes?
Was there a differentiation between apes and other animals?
Yes, there is a hierarchy of animals. Yes, there is a hierarchy of animals. There's a long discussion. This was a question whether between apes and other animals. There is a long discussion. There is a kind of hierarchy between animals, but the apes is at the top of the animal hierarchy. So all other animals are relatively lower.
Did this imply a relationship, a closer relationship between men and apes?
Yes. When, I don't want to go into it now, Mr. Friedman, I'll come back to it a little later, but when Africa was discovered, it was thought that the pygmies, for example, were really apes because they were small and so on. And it was thought that, that they were really apes, yes? Because there must be no gap. And then the pygmies were thought to be the missing link. That's a famous phrase of the 18th century, the missing link in the chain of being. But right now I'm not concerned in the chain of being and racism so much, as I'm really concerned that the understanding of God's universe meant that man was an integral part of the link in an unbroken chain of being, that there was a unity between God, nature, and man. And that unity expressed itself in a hierarchy, in an arrangement, if you like, of all creatures of heaven and earth. The angels, the stars, I forgot the stars, nature, I forgot nature, men, beasts. There is a cosmic order, and that cosmic order passes from the highest to the lowest. Now here again, I could make a long excursion about alchemy and how important alchemy was, because the whole matter of alchemy is based that the highest always that the lowest always reaches out to the highest. That therefore stone always has its in it to become gold. And the highest is always latent in the lowest. So alchemy is involved in this golden chain of being, but I won't go into that now. But it gives people a security, a very secure place that must be clear. There must be no gap here. And that universe is a Christian universe at the moment. A Christian universe, because at its top are God and Christ, and its bottom is the devil. And man, in fact, isn't so fixed. Man is only fixed in this life, but in the next life, of course, he has the hope of skipping in the golden chain of being, of either going down to the devil or going up, depending. Now, this is echoed in the famous line of a poem, which you perhaps know, but which I will be happy to cite. God's parent hand from the mute shellfish gasping on the shore, to men, to angels, to celestial minds, forever leads the generations on to higher scenes of being. This is Pope, of course, Pope's famous line. Now, what Pope is really saying here, God's parent hand from the mute shellfish gasping on the shore, to men, to angels, to celestial minds, forever leads the generation on to higher chains of being, is that in that chain there is latent always the impetus to get up higher in the chain. Because at the apex of God and Christ, the impetus is always to get higher in the chain. That is to say, to be more virtuous, however you want to put it, to get higher towards the chair of being. Now, let me summarize it this way. The golden chain of being is part of this process of personalization. You are part of a chain, and though God is on the top of the chain, he is not as yet the absent God, Deus absconditus. He is not yet the absent God of the 18th century. He is nevertheless present to warn you, to exhort you. As he talked to Moses, he can talk to you. And he talks to you through the saints. Every neighborhood had a saint. Every village had a saint who usually appeared in a tree, a sacred tree that goes back to pagan times. And in every village there was a shrine to the saint in the sacred tree. And every village competed with another village whose saint had performed the greater miracles. So these things were very much present. They were very much symbol of hope, as miracles are, of course, symbols of hope. And the local saint was very much present. He wasn't just an abstraction. And he was present, of course, through his statue in the church, which you could touch. And he was present, and so, in fact, was Christ in the liturgy itself. Animals, similarly, were always personalized. So you have all of this, a kind of personal God against the Enlightenment's impersonality. Now, I must stress that. The great change of the Enlightenment, the impersonality. God as a clockmaker. Voltaire did not believe that God could talk through the burning bush. God had created the world and was now emeritus. Yes? Now that's rather frightening, because where are you? Where are you? You're governed by the natural laws, another abstraction, as you would say. God made laws of nature, but these laws of nature are mathematical. You can get them through your reason and through learning. Through learning and reason, you can find them out. But that is small comfort, really, for the man who is not learned. And it is no real substitute, of course, for a universe of faith. All phenomena could be made analogous. One final example, then I think I will have driven it home to you. When in 1350, or towards 1350, in the Renaissance, Petrarch climbed Mount Ventoux in France, one of the first mountain expeditions we know. What did he do on the top of the mountain? Well, he didn't do what you would do of the top of the mountain. When we go on the top of the mountain, it's a glorification of the power of man. Somehow, we reach out for the sky. We even have a phrase. We say we're closer to the sky. We have had an effort. We have proved our manliness. The women will excuse me, but that becomes very important, of course, because our century is also first the emancipation, then the de-emancipation of women, as you will see. So you prove your manliness, climb, and so on. And you reach for the sky, in a way. But what did Petrarch do when he was on top? He sat down and read St. Augustine. That is to say, he made it an exercise in humility, in what you might call Christian humility. The mountain was assimilated into the Christian universe, in other words, in a sense, cut down to size again, where with us it is done quite differently. Now, all of this having been said, and I think is clear enough, I want to come now to what I might call the greatest summary of Christian thought before Christianity lost its monopoly. I want now to come to that summary of Christian thought which is quite removed from popular culture. But we are now going away from popular culture. In this course, we come back to it with the Second Reformation. Typical. We'll come back to it when we talk about pietism and evangelism. Now, as we first come to the Enlightenment, the great change towards modernity, the acceptance of modernity, industrialization, middle-class society, and all of this, we must look at Christianity from a slightly more, if you like, sophisticated way, and look at the great summary before Christianity lost its monopoly. Some people would say that there has never been again such a great summary of Christianity, perhaps Kierkegaard, but they would be right. I want to start, really, the discussion of the Enlightenment with Blaise Pascal. Now, you may say, why do you start the discussion of the Enlightenment now, after having said all of this about Christianity? Why do you start the Enlightenment with Blaise Pascal and his famous book, The Pensée, The Thoughts, but it's usually, the French is usually kept, of 1660. Now, why do you start with that? And I start with that because in Pascal, you already have a transposition of faith and doubt, but as yet within a Christian universe, and as yet within Christian presuppositions. In Pascal, you already have raised themes which will haunt us almost to this day, the theme of totality and other themes, as you will see. They're already raised there. And we must say that Pascal's pensée, in a sense, start what I would call now the prehistory of the Enlightenment. Having said to you what I said about popular culture and Christianity, we must now therefore come to the last great summary of Christianity, where already faith and doubt are mirrored, which in a Hegelian way stands at the crossroads in a way of the dialectic of faith and doubt, of the new doubt and the old faith, but as yet within the universe, of course, of faith. Because Pascal himself, remember, was a mathematician. He was a man of the future, if you like, rather than of the past. Pascal invented the first computer, as you know, the first automatic mathematical machine. He was a man of the future. I think he would have been appalled if he'd seen the future, but never mind. He was a man of the future, then of the past. And yet he was a devout Christian. And indeed, this will coexist. Startling example, famous example, most famous example of all, when Newton, a few years after the Pensée, came to construct his universe, and everything fitted into place mathematical. There was one thing that was irregular. He couldn't fit it in. Those were the famous sunspots. And so what did Newton do? He appealed to God to write the sunspots. It must be a mistake. And indeed, second startling example, Newton, who becomes the symbol of science, thought that his scientific work was no more important than the mystical Christian tracts he wrote. He would have thought at one point that his Christian tracts were much more important than his scientific work. So these things coexisted, faith and doubt, the new and the old. There is never a complete break. The industrialization of Europe was not abrupt. The rise of the middle classes was not abrupt at all. So there is no break. And so, with that, let us look now at Blaise Pascal's great work, the Pensée. Now, the first thing, and I will give you numbers when I read it, in case you want to, it's numbered. These things are numbered in the text. Now, the basis of Pascal is this, and I will read it to you. We must see the universe, the cosmos, at once, at one glance, and not by a process of reasoning, at least to a certain degree. And thus it is rare that mathematicians are intuitive and that men of intuitions are mathematicians, because mathematicians want to treat matters of intuition mathematically and make themselves ridiculous, wishing to begin with definitions and then with axioms, which is not the way to proceed. Not that the mind does not do so, but it does it tacitly, naturally, and without technical rules, for the expression of it is beyond all men, and a few can feel it. Now, what is he really saying there? He says we must proceed from totality. We must proceed from the grasping of the whole universe, and not, as later the Enlightenment will, by reasoning, by mathematical reasoning. We must first have an image of all of it, the golden chain of being, the whole universe. Just as Christianity begins with giving you an image of the whole universe, it isn't built up. You don't logically come to the Christian universe. The Christian universe, you come through reason, but reason is very limited. In the end, you have a leap of faith. You have to believe it, this universe. It is a leap of faith. You cannot construct it mathematically. You cannot make a geometric paradigm of the Christian universe, yes? And so Pascal believes from a totality. You must first grasp the totality, the totality. Just let, as you say, in Christian liturgy, in the Christian Mass, you grasp by faith that the world is from God, that Christ has come to save the world, that there is a golden chain of being, and that you are part of the golden chain of being, that you shouldn't rise above your station in life. All of this you grasp through faith, what Pascalia calls grasping intuitively, and you grasp it as one image. This is quite true. You grasp it as one image in totality. You don't dissect it. You don't dissect it. You can't. Faith and dissection don't go together. You don't dissect it into little pieces here and there and build it up, as it were, mathematically and rationally. Now, this idea of totality becomes of vast importance for us. Why? Because, in a sense, throughout the painful and, in a way, terrible process of industrialization, men reach out not only for certainty but for totality. They don't want to see, and I quote the Enlightenment, the beauty of God in the flea, and first dissect the flea and find out the natural laws of the flea and then see God's beauty in that. They want to grasp the universe whole and immediate, as you grasp it at Mass, as you grasp it anyway in Pascal, as you will say. You will grasp it immediately. And there is another danger, that if you don't grasp the universe as a totality, can you grasp it at all? You only see little things. You never see the whole. You only see the flea and God's beauty in the flea. But you don't see God's beauty in man. You don't see God's beauty in nature. You don't see God's beauty in the sky. The danger is that you get, as it were, constantly smaller and smaller. You get constantly, how shall I put it best? There's a very good German word, which means talking to death. You talk it to death. You examine it to death, but you don't grasp it whole. And there is, in fact, again, a saying you use all the time, I want to see it whole. Don't you ever use that? I want to see it whole. And which means you want to see it in a totality. And one of the great problems with the Enlightenment will be, and with modern science, and with modern liberalism, is the difficulty of seeing things whole. That things are seen rather in segments and constructed in logical segments, because this is a leap of faith. And in fact, this idea of seeing things whole, and I must say it now, comes to us again in the two great philosophies of modern times, Hegel and Marx. It is part of the genius of Hegel and Marx that they tried to combine, as it were, a de-Christianized universe, to a certain degree, certainly with Marx completely, with seeing things whole. And that is, of course, the great problem of modern socialism that was defeated by Lenin, defeated by Bolshevism. But if you follow modern socialist controversy and ideas, the idea is always to try and see things whole, as Marx tried to, and not to see things in little bits. The bourgeoisie, the proletariat, as it were, the superstructure, the means of production. No, you can't see the world like that in economic determinism. You must see it all together. You must somehow, and this was one of Marx's great points, and one of Hegel's great points, and I want you to remember that, great point was, no. You can't see things that way. You can't just say, there's the proletariat and there's the middle classes. There are the means of production and there is human thought. It's all one unity. And that, of course, comes back again to what I said last time, that people's perceptions indeed come from one unity. There is a realism about that. It coincides with reality. So to change the world, you have to see the world as one unity. And that was, of course, a very Christian approach too, Luther's approach, Calvin's approach, that you have to see totality before you can change. You cannot change if you are just a one-issue person, to put it in a very modern way. And to put it in a modern way again, the Enlightenment, this emphasis on reason, was in danger of becoming one issue, the danger of constructing a universe logically. And through the logic, through, as we say in German, I don't know, I suppose it's an English proverb as well, not to see the wood for the trees. Does that mean anything to you? Yes. Well, that's exactly what is involved. So the basis of Pascal, therefore, is the idea of totality. The idea of the totality of things must be quite clear. But there is in Pascal also the golden chain of being. For Pascal tells us, since everything then is cause and effect, dependent and supporting, mediate and intermediate, all is held together by a natural though imperceptible chain which binds together things most distant and things most different. I hold it equally impossible to know the parts without knowing the whole. And here is another attack on the science of his day. You can examine the flea, and you can examine the ape, and you can examine men, yeah? But you won't know the golden chain of being. You first have to grasp it whole. And that you can only do through a leap of faith. I'll come to that in a minute. So here you have a second attack using this image which I've just talked about, the image of the golden chain of being. You see what I mean? The image of the golden chain of being. You cannot do what the scientists were already doing. You cannot see the beauty of God in a flea and understand the universe. You cannot even dissect man and understand the universe. Before you can understand the flea and man and anything else, you have to grasp the universe whole. And this you can only do through faith. So that the great issue becomes, can you grasp the universe whole by reason? It's a question that Marx will ask, that Hegel will ask, certainly. Marx will ask. Can you grasp the universe whole by reason? Or are we always wedded to faith? And it is very typical that at the beginning of modern times, if you like, stands Pascal using the golden chain of being and this whole issue of totality to defend Christianity, to defend Christianity against its attackers. Because Pascal's work is one of the greatest defenses of Christianity ever made against Christianity's attackers. Especially, as you will see, the doubters, the skeptics, to whom we shall come, of course, a little later. Now, with Pascal, I will, of course, proceed after Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving. Well, a historian is supposed to be beyond time, and therefore, what does it really matter? I don't know what country I'm in sometime. I don't know whom I'm talking to. I'm quite beyond. Don't know what's going on. It's better not to know, don't you think? Anyhow, the question isn't that. I wanted to make one final point, which has nothing to do with what I just said. And that is this. I kind of encourage you to ask questions if you don't understand, because I'm trying to build things up, yes? In fact, I am proceeding with you totally against Pascal's wishes. Yes? I am proceeding with you just the other way. I'm taking little chains of the golden chain and trying to build it up, yes? Rather than of totality, yes, you see? Though if we want, to have a... I don't know how else to do it. But you see, let me just say that. We still have 2 minutes. Let me say this in the 2 minutes. And I'm glad I thought of this, is... You see, because I have to proceed with you that way, because the historian's task is a terrible one, to make the irrational rational. I always have to make the behavior of people and perceptions rational. That's my task in life, to make the irrational rational. I proceed in a way, in a scientific way. I build things up by building blocks. But of course, I falsify, because everything is really a totality, you know. But there is no way, really, for whatever it is, 12 weeks, you see, I could do that other than that we transform this class into a church. And that would be an infringement of the statute of the university, which wants a separation between state and church. So unless we become a church ourselves, there is no way for a historian to start with the totality. We have to start quite different than Pascal. We have to start, and we order things logically for you. And I've been doing that, and I will keep on, though we know very well that life doesn't quite work that way, and that, therefore, we are, in a certain way, falsifying things. So that I come back to what I said, in fact, in the first lecture, that I'm giving you a framework, and that you must go to it with open eyes. You must realize that it is only a stepping stone in the framework, but that in the last resort, as it were, it always comes down to your evaluation, or in this case, to my evaluation, of individual perceptions in a historical framework, perceptions which do not work according to Voltaire, but more, I think, according to Pascal, if the truth must be told. Or more according to popular piety that I talked about today. Yes, the amulets, the little knickknacks. Now I have the word I couldn't find last time. The little knickknacks, you have it too. Every one of you has something around your neck. What else is that than a bit of popular piety that you've hanging around your neck? Yes? So you're not that different, in case you had any illusions. Okay, we'll stop here.